Tom Hayden was a founder of Students for a Democratic Society and later one of the Chicago Seven, the men charged with and later acquitted of conspiring to incite a riot at the 68 Democratic Convention. In the 1980s and 90s, Hayden joined the political mainstream, serving in California's State Assembly and Senate. Tom Hayden stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson about the legacy of the 60s.
I often wonder if I was 5 years older, I'm 67 or thereabouts, whether I would have missed the 60s. It happens that I graduated high school the year that Kerouac's On the Road was finally published. It was also the year of the Little Rock school integration at the point of federal troops. It was 2 years after the Montgomery bus boycott. I think those were precursors of the 60s.
And then Kerouac's book, that had a big impact on you, didn't
it? It had a big impact on everybody. I was part of the hitchhiking generation, but by its very nature, it didn't organize a generation. It touched the feelings of isolated individuals, as did the character Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye, who, as you recall, thought the whole world was a mess, and you find out at the end of the book that he's in a mental institution. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that. And I came out to California as a student editor, and I interviewed Martin Luther King on a picket line. I was still more drawn to a career in journalism, so I was thinking in terms of how the interview with King would get me on the front page of the Michigan Daily, more than to be a suggestion that I should put aside the pen or pick up the picket sign or both.
You were the observer rather than the activist.
I was a kind of observer, I'm ashamed to admit, but I went with students that year to Fayette County, Tennessee, because of something I'd read about sharecroppers displaced from the land, and we brought them food. And that's where I encountered the first sheriff coming up out of the darkness, and my knees buckled, and we were run out of town by maniacs with chains and clubs. And all of these experiences were personal, but also, and I don't want to dwell on it, but I mean, it was quite an incredible time. You know, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Berlin Crisis, which brought the nuclear dread right home. We were closer than ever since to an actual nuclear war. That got into your bones. We were all draft age, too. But things were happening. Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. Betty Friedan wrote Feminine Mystique. Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed. Franz Fanon wrote The Wretched of the Earth. These books all were published in the space of about 1 year, 1961, 1963. SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was formed. This was the blossoming of what I thought must be a social revolution.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you back to 1962 when you and your fellow SDSers.
As long as you know that's 45 years ago. We're still talking about something that happened a very long time
Absolutely.
Ago.
Absolutely. Which has been immortalized in various
Not
books.
Not quite.
The Port Huron Statement, you were the lead writer of that statement. I mean, it has turned into one of the most important political manifestos, I think it's fair to say.
I'm not sure. I would say it's an asterisk for a generation, but
when you look back on that document, how well do you think it still holds up today?
Well, it's got all of the strengths and weaknesses of sophomoric writing, basically. I mean, there's a huge amount of utopianism, idealism that only a young person could have written it. If you looked at it, this is not Karl Marx. This is not C. Wright Mills. This is not John Dewey. This is a self-confident generation finding its voice, really.
And to some degree, rejecting an older generation of leftists, too.
No, there's a generational friction that I think accompanies all these movements. I regret it because it means that the older left had been broken by McCarthyism. It's not entirely a good thing to be new because it means your predecessors have been completely displaced. The other thing about the Port Huron Statement that I do think is lasting is the notion of direct action or participatory democracy as an alternative to merely voting.
So democracy at that time meant you went to the polls, and that's what it meant.
Well, it meant more than that because I couldn't vote. I could be drafted. Blacks in the South couldn't vote. So getting the vote was no small matter, but it was more than getting the vote. It was extending the opportunity to have a voice in decisions beyond the ballot box to the community, to the university, to the workplace.
So where did leadership fit into this whole idea of participatory democracy? I mean, your movement back in the 60s still needed leaders. You were one of them.
The easy answer is that leaders should be elected and rotated and held accountable. And even that is problematic. But there's a role for leadership, but too much of history is considered in terms of leaders. I cringe at things I'm blamed for and things that I'm given credit for. It's all part of the inflation of the individual.
And give me an example of that.
The Port Huron Statement is kind of in between. It is true that I wrote a very long single-spaced draft. It is also true that about 65 people sat for 5 days in small circles, breaking it into component chapters and reconceptualizing it and then voting on it and then turned it back to me for a final polish. So do I get all that credit or does the larger group get that credit? Those are the kind of things that make me cringe.
Now, when you look back on what happened later in the 60s, and particularly your own involvement in the 60s, you were certainly one of the most visible activists during that time. Do you feel like you more or less lived out the principles that you had spelled out in the Port Huron Statement?
Awkwardly. For instance, I've always had an extreme ambivalence about the question of leadership. And I've come to believe that it could be my weakness, can't resolve it, or it could be that it's simply not resolvable given my other beliefs. Sometimes, you know, it's not resolvable because in the electoral system we have, if you want to run for office, you're naturally going to inflate yourself. You know, you're going to take credit for things. You're going to want your name on bills because you can't go to the voters and say, I don't do anything because I don't believe in leadership.
Right. And spoken by a former politician.
Right. So, you know, it's kind of the system imposes certain penalties in life if you choose, for instance, to become involved in politics.
Well, I know to bring our story even closer up to the present here, you teach college students today. I'm sure you give a lot of talks at colleges. What's your sense of how today's activists compare to the way you folks were back in the 60s?
Today's activists as opposed to today's students?
Well, I'll leave that open to your interpretation.
Well, I think that the 60s caused a lot of reforms that have become part of the status quo. The free speech movement, you know, that started over the placement of tables.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it started over moving tables from Sproul Hall to Bancroft and Telegraph and so on. I don't think that a university would be foolish enough to ignite anger over an issue like that, although they're capable of foolishness. I understand that. What I'm saying is that the universities have now become like a soundproof room where it's really hard to shout and feel that you're being heard. You can read Leon Trotsky if you wish. You can read Che Guevara's diaries. You can unearth feminist treasures. The stuff that was forbidden in a time when that was synonymous with it must be radical or revolutionary, the forbidden is now permissible. Secondly, the draft is gone, and there's nothing to get your attention like a military draft. It's an unbelievable existential crisis when you're in that young and transitional period. And then the other thing that's not given much attention is, you know, I went to the University of Michigan for $100. I can't remember if it was $100 a year or a semester.
Cheap, in other words.
Yeah, we had an idea like they have in France, in Mexico, in most civilized countries, that higher education should be free, state subsidized, a state investment in the future. Kind of like Social Security for the elders and free college education for anybody who wants it and is qualified for the youth. Now, it's been brought under the forces of the market where students are, their discretionary time is rationed out very carefully. The competitive stakes are very great when you're trying to get in. I don't remember anybody in my generation having to apply to 25 colleges looking for the good fortune of being admitted to one or two. Now we have a market model, not completely, but a market model that's displacing the old model of college funding. And that's got to have an effect on behavior. And it's got to induce more apathy than alienation, I would think.
Which is interesting because I know apathy was one of those words that you and your fellow activists back in the early 60s railed against.
Well, yeah, we railed against it, but remember, we had discretionary time. I could drop out of the university and nothing would happen. I could go to jail in Mississippi, nothing would happen. I could return and pay my $100 and get back in. This is a treadmill that today's students are on that we didn't face. We thought our life was, you know, the future was a treadmill, the gray flannel suit and all that, but nothing compared to the pressure on this generation of students.
Tom Hayden, talking with Steve Paulson. Hayden was one of the founders of Students for a Democratic Society and later a state assemblyman and senator in California.